trade, tariff, taxes, and a little bit of baseball. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizal. It is Thursday today, the fifth day of April. Good as always to have you along, everybody. We begin today in a trade-heavy economic environment with the most commonly cited measure of America's global trade economy, something called the trade deficit, sometimes the trade gap, but by whatever name, one of the key economic irritants experienced by the President of these United States. We got the February trade report from the good people at the Commerce Department this morning. All the goods and services we buy from overseas, minus what other countries buy from us. And in February, for the sixth month in a row, the U.S. trade deficit grew, got bigger, despite President Trump's repeated promises to shrink it. But in a way, as Marketplace's Tracy Samuelson reports, it's not really the president's fault.
The good, the less good, and China. The trade deficit in three parts. Good news first. Why is the trade deficit growing now?
It widens in every boom period when the economy domestically is at full employment.
Barry Bosworth is an economist at the Brookings Institution.
We import consumption goods. So when consumption is strong, a lot of those imports are going to come in, mainly, I would say, from China.
Carl Tannenbaum, chief economist with Northern Trust, says a trade deficit can actually be a sign of economic strength. But the bad news?
We would like to see some moderation. Europe in particular has been doing much better over the course of the last 18 months or so, which would suggest that they'd be in a better position to buy more American products from us.
But that's not showing up yet. Tannenbaum says a large trade deficit is not necessarily a sign of unfair trade. Americans save less and consume more than other countries. But the timing of this data is not ideal, says Beth Ann Bovino, the U.S. chief economist at S&P Global Ratings.
And the worry is, since the administration had said many times that one of their policy promises was to narrow the trade deficit, this might encourage the U.S. to become more aggressive with China in their discussions.
A trade war could lower U.S. imports, but it might lower U.S. exports, too. I'm Tracy Samuelson for Marketplace.
We heard a bunch in the program yesterday, and we'll hear some more today about how farmers and government officials in this country are thinking about the not quite yet a trade war thing that China and the United States have going. Right now, from our China correspondent Jennifer Pak, the word from the streets of Shanghai.
China's Vice Finance Minister Zhu Guangyao describes the retaliatory measures as a defensive move forced on China by the U.S.
Both sides have put their lists on the table. Now it's time for negotiations.
But if talks between the two nations break down, he warned,
since the founding of New China in 1949, China has never surrendered to external pressure.
This tough talk wasn't echoed by people I stopped on the streets of Shanghai. Alfred Yu says the news is more like entertainment.
In the China history, we face more and more serious problems than this kind of news before.
His parents' generation saw worse: hunger, social instability, and political turmoil. So far, China has enacted tariffs on a relatively small list of U.S. exports. For people like Roy Ma, who I met outside Starbucks, items like American oranges and nuts will be more expensive.
My consumption of those kind of things is not quite heavy or big.
Many people I spoke to are confident some deal can be reached, but Elliot Huang is not sure.
If you can sit down with President Donald Trump, what would you say to him?
Go away.
He says China-U.S. relations were harmonious until President Trump came into office. His friend Yang Yiwei has an even more blunt message for the president. Stop making trouble. But in reality, the economies of China and the U.S. are so interlinked that each country needs the other. In Shanghai, I'm Jennifer Pak for Marketplace.
A quick detour here to politics before we go into place. Also, the economic branding that we're likely to see lots more of as the November midterms get closer. President Trump went to West Virginia today for a tax roundtable. And in talking about how the tax law came to be, gave a not-so-subtle preview of how the GOP would like the next 7 or 8 months' worth of headlines to go.
I said, don't use the word reform. Use the word tax cut. Because when you talk about tax reform, that could mean your taxes are going up. And your taxes went down. They went down a lot.
Wall Street Today was back in the old tax cut, it's all good mode. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. Imagine your job is in agriculture. Imagine, actually, that your job is managing the agriculture economy in an ag-intensive state. Wait, imagine your job is managing the ag economy in an ag-intensive state where the big ag products are at the top of the Chinese tariffs list that came out the other day. Well, it turns out that person actually exists. His name is Mike Naig. He is the Iowa Secretary of Agriculture, and we got him on the phone. Welcome to the program.
Thanks, Kai.
You've been doing agriculture in Iowa for a very long time. You've officially been on the job for a month, I think. how's it going so far?
Oh, that's right. I've been on the job about a month. I've been covering a lot of ground. You know what? There's been a lot of issues that have bubbled up here over the last 4 weeks or so.
Well, let's talk about the last, 48, maybe 72 hours. First of all, what's your gut reaction about the news of these tariffs and the back and forth between us and the Chinese, a big customer of Iowa Ag?
Very big customer, very important customer. We need that market. They need our products. This is what mutually beneficial trade can look like, right? At the same time, we also know that there are always issues. Certainly intellectual property and licensing, but there have been some barriers on beef and poultry and biotech trade approvals that we certainly would like to see addressed, but absolutely a very real and deep concern out here in Iowa related to the retaliatory measures that China has indicated they would take.
Do you think the Chinese are going specifically after Iowa farmers and that section of the country because they know that's where the president of the United States has a lot of support?
Now, it could be. I mean, I think the fact that we're a significant player in ag exports means that the bullseye does seem like it's coming towards us.
You could probably get, not the president, but you could probably get Wilbur Ross, the Secretary of Commerce, on the phone. You dial him up. You say, Mr. Secretary, listen, I have some thoughts. What are those thoughts?
Well, I think I would echo the sentiment of people that I have been visiting with across the state of Iowa, and that's that we understand that this is a complex trading relationship, but please don't make Iowa farmers and Iowa businesses the leverage or the bargaining chip here as we try to work through these things. So we would ask for that the administration quickly and aggressively engage to try to resolve these issues in a way that minimizes impact on the markets.
Are you or your family, are you still working farmers?
My family, we do have a farm up in northwest corner of the state.
How's business?
Things are tight. Where everybody across the state is watching the expense side of the equation, certainly, and needing to make sure they've got a sharpened pencil when it comes to marketing strategies and then work those strategies. So we're on a four-year decline here of farm income. And so, again, this uncertainty just does not help that situation out here. And that's certainly impacting my family, but other producers across the state, certainly.
Mike Naig, he's the Secretary of Agriculture for the state of Iowa. Mr. Secretary, thanks for your time, sir. I appreciate it.
Absolutely. Good to be with you.
We're going to pick up another thread from yesterday's program now, your global trade and tariff questions, our answers via our Twitter feed. We are at Marketplace, by the way, if you've got one for us. At Wesley Sarti wanted to know what the next best alternative markets might be for some of the products that both China and the United States are targeting with those tariffs. Marketplace's Aaron Schrank is on that one.
This one is basically a math problem. We can look at the next biggest export markets for goods on either side of the tariff equation. Both countries will look to send more of these targeted products to those countries. So more Chinese TV sets will go to Japan, Canada, Mexico, and Australia. Printers, China's next biggest markets are Iran, Russia, and Canada. Meanwhile, China has proposed tariffs on U.S. soybeans. We also sell those to Mexico, the Netherlands, Japan, and Taiwan. But China is far and away the U.S.'s largest market, and even adding all of those other buyers together probably won't make that up.
At Vats23 had this. How will Chinese consumption change with the tariffs? He wanted to know any historical data points. Here we go again, Aaron Schrank.
If the tariffs go into place, the average Chinese consumer probably won't notice much of a difference because the tariffs targeting $50 billion in U.S. products all told accounted for less than 3% of China's total imports last year. And China can source almost all of these products from other countries. Brazil can send more soybeans, perhaps at a higher cost. China can buy more German Airbus A320s instead of Boeing 737s. But the tariffs going the other way could also impact Chinese consumption, because China may first look to make up for a loss of U.S. demand by increasing domestic consumption. Experts say that's something Beijing has been pushing. But Chinese per capita income is still low in much of the country.
That middle bit right there, the Brazilian soybeans and the European Airbuses, that's a key thing. Pay attention to that. If you missed our trade Q&A on yesterday's program, you can catch it on our podcast wherever you choose to get your podcast. Subscribe while you're at it. Leave us a review. Just be kind, would you? You can also send us more questions at marketplace.org or on Twitter. At Kai Rizdahl is me. You spell it just the way it sounds. At Marketplace is the show. As I said a little bit ago, President Trump put taxes back on the front burner today at that event in West Virginia. For a lot of small business people, though, the new tax law has been on the front burner since it passed last December. In particular, a new deduction for what's known as pass-through income. Businesses and some individuals who don't pay corporate taxes, but whose business income passes through to their individual returns and can be taxed at their individual rate. And now with the new tax code, as I said, there's also a new 20% deduction on their overall taxable income. So, of course, just about everybody is trying to qualify, as Marketplace's Nancy Marshall Genza reports.
The pass-through deduction was made for guys like 29-year-old Christian Perea, an Uber driver and writer in San Francisco. He's an independent contractor who works out of his apartment.
You might hear my cat meowing in the background.
I spoke to Perea on Skype. He told me he drives 5 to 10 hours a week, mostly as research for his main job, writing for RideshareGuy.com, a blog for Uber and Lyft drivers. He's become something of an expert lately on gig workers and the pass-through deduction.
I'm excited that I might be able to save money.
Perea says his income varies, but typically it's under $70,000 a year. That qualifies him easily to shave 20% off his taxable income because the threshold for the pass-through deduction is roughly $157,000 in taxable income for individuals and double that for joint filers. Perea figures he'll save up to $4,000 on his taxes next year.
I think that this is definitely going to help me be able to do what I want as a self-employed individual or even starting a business.
We've helped many Uber drivers, independent contractors, Lyft drivers, gig workers, even people who play music, who incorporate and then have this sort of tax savings.
That's attorney Deborah Sweeney, CEO of MyCorporation.com. It helps entrepreneurs and small businesses incorporate. Sweeney says business is up almost 20% over last year, because so many people are trying to take advantage of the pass-through deduction, including Sweeney and her husband, who both have small businesses.
We actually just recently met with our accountant, and he said, this is going to be great.
She figures they'll save around $28,000 next year. The deduction may also be great for other small business people like plumbers, hairstylists, and realtors. But high earners in specific fields like law, medicine, and investment management generally can't take the deduction because, in the eyes of the IRS, their biggest asset is their reputation or skill. It's complicated. And in tax law, complications are the mother of invention.
This is the loophole that your accountant can blow up.
Nick Scher is a 33-year-old CPA in Manhattan. He's been talking with clients about various ways they can squeeze through the pass-through loophole.
So let's say there's a radiologist.
And she owns her own equipment. What she could do
is spin off a business.
That business would own the equipment. The radiologist would rent it from herself. And that new equipment rental business would get the 20% pass-through deduction. Scher says you can also become a corporation and put yourself on the payroll. He recently did that for a client.
Net net, he's up $71,100. I've earned my keep.
When Scher isn't hunting for pass-through loopholes for clients, he's trying to figure out how to get the deduction for himself. Scher rents an office in an expensive building on Park Avenue. He'd like to set up a real estate company to buy office space. He would then lease the space from his new real estate company. Pass-through deduction accomplished.
I.e. my right pocket will be paying my left pocket.
If you think this deduction is just the preoccupation of accountants, let me direct you to the latest episode of the Showtime series Homeland, where a Russian operative is blackmailing an attorney who fraudulently got Medicaid to cover her aging mother.
Even though she has assets of millions of dollars, assets you have hidden through two pass-through corporations.
Ooh, the suspense. Almost as exciting as waiting for the final pass-through regulations from the IRS sometime later this year. In Washington, I'm Nancy Marshall Genzer for Marketplace.
Not one, but two pass-through corporations in that clip, right? Coming up.
During spring training, 7 days per week, often 10-hour days, they haven't been paid at all for that.
Better up on the cheap. But first, just as you count on Marketplace for reliable, in-depth news and information, we are counting on listeners like you to invest in what we do. The more people who support Marketplace, the more we can do to raise economic intelligence across this country. So before we do today's numbers, here is another number to think about. $5 a month. $5 a month, and you can become a Marketplace investor. The payoff? Knowing that you're helping thousands of people understand this economy, having conversations that matter, and making better financial decisions. Donate today at marketplace.org, and thanks. Dow Industrials gained 0.9% today, 240 points, 24,505 for the blue chips. NASDAQ added 0.4%, about 34 points, 7,076. The S&P 500 picked up 0.6%, that is 18 points. Finished the session at 2662. Tech stocks did their part. Facebook shares clicked up 2.7% today. Amazon boxed up nearly 3%. Tesla continued what's being called its relief rally, as its investors are relieved the company isn't going to need to raise more capital. Shares drove up 6.5%. Also, 6.5% is another way to say that. Yesterday, trade drama appears to have been recast as the early stages of a negotiation. Today's relative calm helped Boeing regain a little bit of lift. Its shares rose 2.7%. You're listening to Marketplace.
Looking for the highest interest rate on your cash? At Public.com, you can earn 5.1% APY with a high-yield cash account. And while we can't say it's officially the highest interest rate out there, we can say this. It's a higher rate than Robinhood, a higher rate than SoFi, a higher rate than Marcus, a higher rate than Wealthfront, frankly, a higher rate than Capital One, a higher rate than Ally, a higher rate than Barclays, a way higher rate than Bank of America and Chase, a higher rate than Citi, Wells Fargo, Discover, and it's a higher rate than American Express, too. So if you want to start earning 5.1% APY on your cash, check out public.com. We can't say it's the highest interest rate, but it's pretty darn up there. This is paid for by Public Investing. 5.1% APY as of March 26, 2024, and is subject to change. A high-yield cash account is a secondary brokerage account with Public Investing, member FINRA/SIPC. Funds from this account are automatically deposited into partner banks where they earn a variable interest and are eligible for FDIC insurance. Neither Public Investing nor any of its affiliates is a bank. U.S. only. Learn more at public.com/disclosure/high-yield-account.
This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We did apples and hogs and tariffs on the program yesterday. Today we're going to do the original white meat. There weren't any direct chicken meat tariffs on the list Beijing put out yesterday. Some equipment stuff, yes. But this is a global agriculture economy. So we've called a chicken farmer we know to see what he knows. Ed Fryer is the CEO of Ozark Mountain Poultry in Batesville, Arkansas. Mr. Fryer, good to talk to you again, sir.
Hello, Kai. It's good to talk with you.
So the reason we've called you, Mr. Fryer, is because you're in agriculture, obviously. You're concerned about this, I imagine, but you're kind of on the periphery. So give me a sense of your stress level about these tariffs and all this trade war talk on a scale of 1 to 10, 10 being really concerned and 1 not so much.
I'm going to be anywhere from about a 2 to about an 8.
Okay.
And it depends. What it depends on is right now this feels more like a trade spat than it does a real trade war.
Yep.
If it's just a trade spat and this thing is all resolved, then I think the effect of what's happened or what's been announced so far will be minimal. If this is the beginning of a honest-to-goodness trade war, then I'm up there at about an 8 or so because it will get much uglier than what it has appeared to be so far.
How are you going to know that it's and let me take this moment to remind folks, you're actually an economist, as I say every time we get you on. How are you going to know? What are you looking for to know whether it's actually turning into something more serious?
The first thing would be for the announced tariffs to actually go into effect.
Yeah.
We're at least a month, maybe as long as 3 months away before these tariffs actually go into effect. So that gives people, the U.S. and China, a lot of time to sit down and negotiate and work something out. You know, it's one thing for my cousin and I, when we were growing up, to sit there and say, yeah, well, I dare you. Okay, well, I double dare you. Well, I double dog dare you. And usually by the time we got to that point, my grandparents would intervene or my parents, so it was over with. As long as it's that type of a thing, then I think it's going to be minimal effect.
Yeah.
If it goes beyond that, then it could really get ugly.
There's lots on this list that is tangential to what you do. Hogs, right? A competition for chicken meat. soybean and corn in terms of feed for your birds. How closely are you watching that stuff? Because it could wind up being all right for you, you know?
It actually could be. Although I would much rather have all of this resolved.
Yeah.
There's enough uncertainty to begin with, and this just adds another layer of uncertainty. But if this causes soybean prices to drop, if corn goes down, obviously those are better for us because we're a consumer of both of those. Hog prices going down do not help us because that's a competitor for our meat, chicken versus pork. But let me temper all of that by saying that at this point, other than causing some extra nervousness, I don't think there's been any real impact on the market yet.
Hmm.
Now, I know soybeans were down like 50 cents early yesterday morning after that announcement was made, but I think a lot of that was due just to the classic the fog of battle.
Sure.
The market came back. I think today the market's down around 10 to 15 cents from where it was prior to yesterday.
Hmm. You watch it every day. You watch those spot prices every single day in the futures as well, yeah?
I don't watch them that closely every day, but I am very much aware of what they are. $30 to $35 a ton on soybean meal cost us an additional penny a pound on a live weight basis. And, you know, a penny a pound in our industry, profits in our industry are measured in pennies. Not nickels or dimes, but pennies. So you've got to watch those commodity prices.
Interesting. Ed Fryer, he's the CEO of Ozark Mountain Poultry. We got him down in Batesville, Arkansas. Mr. Fryer, thanks a lot for your time, sir. I appreciate it.
Thanks, Guy. Enjoy talking with you.
We're a week or so into the baseball season in the big leagues. Down in the minors, today is opening day. And while some of those guys in the lower rungs are playing for the love of the game, for a lot of them, their paychecks don't come to much more than the love of the game. Players in the minors are under a standard contract. Starts at about $7,000 for the whole season, which goes about 6 months. And there is no sign of a base pay raise in the offing, as Marketplace's Mitchell Hartman reports.
Garrett Brushhouse went to the University of Missouri on a baseball scholarship and in 2004 got drafted to pitch for one of the San Francisco Giants minor league teams.
There's no better feeling than being on a mound and competing.
Except he didn't love trying to make it on a starting salary of $1,100 a month.
Guys living either sleeping on some stranger's futon at a host family's house or they're cramming six guys into a three-bedroom apartment, trying to split rent as many ways as possible.
Brushhouse pitched for 6 years, went on to law school, and in 2014 brought a class action lawsuit against the baseball owners. The goal? To force the teams to pay players per hour, including for all their hours playing and practicing, and in the month before the season starts. Because as it stands now under their contract,
during spring training, 7 days per week, often 10-hour days, they haven't been paid at all for that.
Last month, the players' lawsuit was dealt a major setback by Congress, which passed the Save America's Pastime Act, that's really what it's called, as part of the omnibus spending bill. The act exempts baseball teams from having to pay minor league players minimum wage and overtime for all hours worked. Its sponsors in Congress said it was needed to protect the teams and the cities they play in from financial hardship. Sports law expert Kenneth Shropshire at Arizona State explains how that argument goes.
If you put in place a regular hourly wage, the amount of time that a ball player wants to put in to be great, come in early, stay late, it could never be covered, that it would far exceed 40 hours per week.
Major League Baseball, which sets and pays minor league salaries, provided Marketplace with a statement that it's proper for minor league players to be treated as salaried, not hourly workers. In a fact sheet, it said that average pay ranges from $1,300 a month at the lowest A-level ball to $10,000 a month in AAA, and that many players get signing bonuses. Shropshire says the owners are sending a message with their resistance to paying players more.
Isn't it a luxury to be able to be a professional baseball player? You're so fortunate to be able to do so. Here's the sacrifice you have to make. But look at the upside if you are successful in the end.
Jared Eichelberger says he sure remembers the sacrifices he made playing for 3 years for the Mets and Mariners minor league teams. During the offseason, he'd do construction and odd jobs. Then the season started and he'd be scrimping and saving on food.
Apples, oranges, bananas, peanut butter jelly, whatever you could do to eat, because it was almost survival.
Eichelberger now runs a baseball training business in San Diego. He says if he were a player today, he'd probably support the lawsuit for hourly and overtime pay, but he doesn't regret having played for peanuts. He says it's a rite of passage and well worth the hardship for a shot at the majors. I'm Mitchell Hartman for Marketplace.
Final note on the way out today, which comes as Saudi Crown Prince Mohammed bin Sultan continues his tour of the United States. One of the things the Crown Prince is doing is opening up the kingdom's entertainment industry. Told you a couple of months ago, the Saudis had allowed the first public movie showing in 35 years, the Emoji Movie, for some reason, shown in a state-run cultural center. They have made a better choice, I'm happy to tell you, with the first film that's going to run in an actual movie theater, Black Panther, premiering in Riyadh at the end of the month. All right, we got to go. Dow Industrial's up 0.9% today, 240 points. NASDAQ up 0.4%, about 34 points. S&P 500 picked up 0.6%, 18 points there. John Buckley, Eve Epstein, John Gordon, Danielle Irby, and Betsy Streisand are the Marketplace editing staff. The managing editor is Deirdre Depke. I'm Kai Rizdal. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.